Well, as Chris mentioned, we wrap up our series tonight where we've been looking at the identity of Jesus based on our questions we've put to the coast. But I want to point out that actually every week in church, we consider the identity of Jesus. And so we'd love to see you back again because this doesn't finish here. We do this every week. We'd love for you to keep investigating him. And the response that we are dealing with tonight was one of the most popular that we got when we put this question to the coast. And it's a response that contains an acknowledgement and a doubt or query or question. There's an acknowledgement there, yeah, that Jesus did exist, that he was a man of history. And he was such a man of history, he made such a splash through history that he must have been something special. So it affirms that he lived, that he existed, that he was something special. But then the doubt, the query, the question is, but was he God? Was he God? And it's possible to ask that question genuinely, sincerely. And I trust that you might be one of those people tonight. Yeah, was he God? And I want to say that if you're genuinely asking that question, there's something very appropriate about that because you acknowledge that there is a God, that the shape of your life says that there must be. But God is not just a rock star, not just an impressive person. God is almighty. He's huge. He's way bigger than any finite human being with all their limitations. And yet, it's absolutely central to the Christian message of the Bible that this all-powerful God is the humble carpenter who was born in Palestine, who grew up on their dusty streets. Now, I've actually got a bunch of mates who are carpenters, and they clearly are not God. So, what would make you think any different about a man who swung a hammer 2,000 years ago? That's the question I want to ask and consider with you tonight. Now, I want to bring to you a whole bunch of evidence for Jesus being God. But before we get there, two points of context that are important to bear in mind as we work through the evidence. The first one is about the Bible. See, the bulk of what we know about Jesus comes to us in the Bible. Now, if you were with us on the first and second weeks of this series, you'll remember that there's a whole stack of information about Jesus outside of the Bible that back up the claims made about him in the Bible. But for some of you, you might be thinking, oh, that's convenient. You're going to say Jesus was God because the Bible said so, because that person who wrote the Bible said that he was God. But, and chase this up if you weren't with us, week one and two we pressed into this, that is to forget that the Bible is actually a library. It's actually a collection of many different documents. This is just kind of like a manila folder holding it together. Documents that have been written over the course of 1,500 years by over 40 authors across three continents in three languages. And when you come to the library, you find that it's divided into two main parts. You have the Old Testament, which is kind of the first two-thirds of it. And it was written centuries before Jesus. And it concerns the God of the Hebrews, the God of the Jews, and the promises that he made to them, and the way that he started to fulfill those promises through history. The Old Testament was written up to about the point of 400 BC. Then you come to the New Testament, which is much shorter. It was written around 50 AD to 90 AD, and it centers around the person of Jesus and how he actually fulfills all of those promises that were made in the Old Testament. Now, the first part of the New Testament, we find a four gospel accounts. They're the accounts of Jesus' life. Two of them were written by his disciples, men that traveled with him, Jewish men. Another man, Luke, tells us that he carefully investigated the things about Jesus. He interviewed people. Then you have in the New Testament the writings of the apostles, who were Jewish men who had lived with Jesus, spent time with Jesus, and were appointed by Jesus to speak about him and for him. Now, the evidence that I present you tonight for Jesus being God trades upon this collection of documents to be reliable, to be trustworthy, to actually be well-preserved documents of history. And if you haven't investigated that, then for tonight you might have to suspend disbelief so that you can track with the arguments of the Bible, so that you can see the logic of them to hold Jesus up as God. But the onus is on you to investigate the reliability of these documents before you write them off as myth and make-believe. So I encourage you to do that. If you haven't yet done that, as you've heard, life will be a great place to do it. So you got that? The evidence that I'm bringing you tonight comes from these documents of history that have an overwhelming amount of evidence to show them to be trustworthy. Now, the second point of context is the religious setting that Jesus was born into and the New Testament grew out of, and that is Judaism. First century Judaism was, as it is today, fiercely monotheistic, which means they believed in one universal God, not many gods. And I say fiercely because if you considered any one or thing other than the God of the Hebrew Bible to be God, it was considered blasphemy, which deserved death, death by stoning usually. They are very important facts to be kept in mind as we look at the evidence tonight. So, as for the evidence for Jesus being God, you would not appreciate me bringing even half of it to you tonight. We'd be going forever. Because in fact, Jesus claims that the whole Bible is about him and seeks to show his true identity. So my plan is to actually just give you a taste of the multiple lines of evidence that converge on Jesus being God. But even though it's a taste, there's actually quite a lot. And so if you start to numb at the amount of evidence, I'm kind of okay with that. If it at least means you acknowledge that this isn't a childish fantasy, that there's actually a whole lot of ground on which these claims stand. And I've already met a couple of people tonight, which is awesome, who are brand new to church. It's so good to have you with us. And we have people like you with us every week. And so don't be overwhelmed by this, please. I hope that it just stirs you to push into it further, to investigate it further. Now, I've categorized the evidence and structured it pretty highly to try and help us as we work through it. But the two broad categories of evidence are claims that Jesus is God and proof that Jesus is God. This is how we'll be working through it. Now, the claims for Jesus being God are an important part of the evidence because they interpret the proof of him being God. So consider this made-up example. If I were to say to you, I lost my leg while serving as a soldier in Afghanistan when a bomb went off, you might say, prove it. And so I pull up my pant and you see a titanium leg. Now, that proof throws light back on the claims that I've made, who I am, what I've done, how I heard it. The evidence, the proof is one thing, but it's actually the claims that help you understand and interpret the proof. So we'll spend quite a bit of time on the claims of Jesus being God. So let's jump into that. Firstly, by looking at the claims that Jesus was God made by others, people other than Jesus, which is actually the first and most obvious evidence you come across when you pick up the New Testament to read it. There's many examples that I could give you for all of these lines of evidences. That's actually more lines that I'll give you. So this is just a taste, but track with me to try and see what is being said. The first one I want to show is from John's Gospel. John was a disciple of Jesus, and he writes an account of his life, and he begins his account like this. Now, I'm going to bounce around a lot of different places, but each of the key verses will come up on the screen, so if you don't have a Bible, that's cool. I've got John chapter 1. Let's read that together on the screen. Hopefully. We got that there?
No.
Apparently not. Is it possible to get that there? No. Listen in. We'll see if we can work on that, because I really want you to be able to see these verses for yourself. John chapter 1, what you're trying to pay attention to here is the Word. The Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. You come down to verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Come to verse 18. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. Now, there's a number of profound things being said there, two of them being that God is incredibly complex, that our finite minds couldn't even come up with this God. But secondly, it's saying that he is personal, that God is not like the Force on Star Wars, but rather he is relational. And before he had relationship with us, people who are relational, he had relationship within himself as Father, Son, and Spirit. Three persons, yet one God. The main point that I want to make is verse 18 and 14. Verse 18 says, the God who is unseen has made himself known, has made himself seen. Verse 14 says, the Word became flesh. That God, the one who was with God, the one who is God, became flesh. Now notice the order. A man didn't become God. God became a man. The claim isn't that some Palestinian man named Jesus lived such a good life that he was kind of elevated to the status of deity, but rather that God the Son became flesh, born as the human Jesus. Now, I've witnessed three births of children myself, and I got a fourth one not far away. In fact, I actually delivered one of my kids. So I mentioned that to you before. I kind of like to whenever I can. I get how absurd the claim can sound that the eternal, powerful God came as a humble, dependent little baby. But that clearly is what John is claiming. God became a man. He made himself known in the man Jesus. You get other examples in the New Testament. See if we can bring those up. You see them in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, that the Son is the image of the invisible God. Come down to 19. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. That's important. You don't have a half God, half man. You have God in all his fullness coming into a man, a full man, as you and I know a man. A couple of verses later in chapter 2. In Christ, all the fullness of deity lives in bodily form. All of it. You see it again in another letter to the Hebrews. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. So that's the first line of evidence that the predominantly Jewish writers of the New Testament were clearly convinced that God showed up on earth as the man Jesus. Now you might say, well, sure, anyone can, after someone's died, say, well, he was God, and kind of write that and go on with that. They might have been touched by the life and teaching of Jesus and kind of elevated him to God's status. Now, I'll come back later as to why that objection makes no sense, but let's go straight to the words of Jesus. Would he be turning in his grave at the thought of people worshipping him as God? The answer is no, when you look at the words that came from his lips. Now, there's two kind of categories you could put the words of Jesus into more explicit claims to being God and more implicit ones. Let me give you an example of the explicit type. Again, from John's Gospel, chapter 14, says Jesus, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." Verse 9. "Anyone who has seen me," says Jesus, "has seen the Father." They're referring to God. Anyone who has seen Jesus has seen God. You get another example in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 26. This is on the eve of Jesus' death, and he's before the Jewish leaders, religious rulers, where we read, "The high priest said to Jesus, 'I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God.' 'You have said so,' Jesus replied. 'But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven.' Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, 'He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?' 'He is worthy of death,' they answered." Clearly, the Jews understood the claims that Jesus was making. They clearly understood Jesus claiming to be God. Now, that doesn't prove that he was, but it proves that Jesus had this understanding of himself, not just others' opinion of him. Let me give you an example of the more implicit type of statement from Jesus. And it's actually an extraordinary category, this one, particularly as you have an appreciation of the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament. So it's a little bit like watching the third installment of The Lord of the Rings without having watched or read number one and two. You'll enjoy the movie, you'll get the movie, but not to the same degree as you would if you'd seen or read what came prior. It's a bit like that with the New Testament and the Old Testament, in that you can read the New Testament and understand it, and in fact, if you've not read the Bible, start there. But to actually understand it and get a deeper appreciation of it, you need to be digging into the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, the Hebrew Scriptures, as I said, written centuries before Jesus, declare that there is one God and that his name is Yahweh. Now, Yahweh sounds like an odd name to us because it's actually a Hebrew name. A Hebrew name that gets translated into English as Lord. Now, the writings of the Old Testament closed about 400 BC, but then Greek culture emerged. And as that happened, the Hebrew scriptures were translated into the common tongue of Greek. And so when that happened, the name Yahweh, which is Hebrew, was translated Kurios, which is the Greek translation. When we translate that Greek into English, we get Lord. And our Bibles, our English translations, differentiate the two with a capital L-O-R-D for one that's going straight to Yahweh, the Hebrew text. Big L, little O-R-D for Kurios. Now, the reason this is significant is that the New Testament applies to Jesus that which is said about Yahweh in the Old Testament. About Yahweh, the Creator God, the Eternal God, the All-Powerful God, the All-Knowing God. This is staggering. I'll give you an example from Isaiah chapter 40, which was written many, many centuries before Jesus. We read, "A voice of one calling, 'In the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord, for Yahweh. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God.'" There's Yahweh, God. "And the glory," verse 5, "of Yahweh will be revealed, and all people will see it together. For the mouth of Yahweh has spoken." In other words, what's being said there is the God of the Bible, Yahweh, is coming to town. He's coming to earth. But his arrival won't be a complete surprise. There'll actually be someone who comes before him to announce his presence. Then, we come to Matthew's gospel centuries later. Matthew being one of the eyewitness accounts of Jesus, chapter 3, where we read, "In those days, John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea and saying, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near.' This is he who was spoken of through the prophet Isaiah." And he's now quoting what we just read. He's quoting the Old Testament. "A voice of one calling in the wilderness, 'Prepare the way for the Lord,'" for Yahweh, "'Make straight paths for him.'" You come down 10 verses to verse 13 and you read, "Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John." And actually, Matthew's account goes on to show you that Yahweh, who promised centuries before, was now here in Jesus. That John the Baptist was actually that guy who was announcing his presence. Then Jesus steps onto the stage. You get other examples of this. That'll do for now. But okay, maybe John the Baptist and Matthew thought, "Oh, this will be cool. Jesus, he can be Yahweh. He can be the one who will fulfill what we've been waiting for centuries for and not seen." Did this carpenter Jesus, the Jewish Jesus, who knew these scriptures, who lived by these scriptures, who revered these scriptures, did he really rock up and say, "Hey guys, I'm him. I'm the God of the scriptures"? The answer is yes, he did. There's a number of examples. Let me give you one where Jesus implicitly says, "I'm God," by identifying himself as Yahweh. The context is Ezekiel, a prophet similar stage, vintage to Isaiah, centuries before Jesus. And the context there in chapter 34 is Yahweh is rebuking the religious leaders of the day. And he's using a metaphor of shepherd and sheep to point out how bad a job these men have done. So bad a job that they're pictured not as shepherds, but actually as wolves feeding on the very sheep that they were intended to care for. The result being that these sheep have actually scattered and are a long way from home. So we read in Ezekiel 34:11, "For this is what sovereign Yahweh says, 'I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so will I look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on a day of clouds and darkness.'" Verse 15, "I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares sovereign Yahweh. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice." You know that saying, if you want a job done well, do it yourself? That's pretty much what God is saying right here. "Men, you religious leaders, I'm going to come and do what you are supposed to do. I'm coming to town." Then, centuries later, we have recorded in John's Gospel, chapter 10, Jesus speaking to the Pharisees who were among the religious leaders of his day, where he said, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Jesus could have used any number of metaphors to make his point here. But instead he goes straight for the shepherd sheep one so that he can say, "Hey guys, you know the scriptures, you know Ezekiel 34, I'm here. God Almighty, Yahweh, is here to bring back his sheep." The point of this line of evidence is that God coming to live among us as one of us was not some first century invention. It wasn't a fourth century invention, aka the Da Vinci Code and conspiracy theory. Rather, the roots for the claims that Jesus is God are buried centuries before his life. You know, Jesus' claim to be Yahweh wasn't lost on many of those who were present when he said this. Because we read on verse 20, they said, "He is raving mad. Why listen to him?" That's a good question. Why listen to Jesus? That takes us from that category of claim into the category of proof. Now, I'll do this by dividing it into two broad sections. That is, proof looking at Jesus, proof looking at others. So the first proof that Jesus was God that we see, well, the first one that I'm going to show you, is that he was sinless. Now, our community at large doesn't like the concept of sin and has pretty much pushed it to the side and maybe applies it to things like rape and murder and pedophilia and those kind of things. But ironically, to actually do that, to actually say, no, we don't like the idea of sin, okay, maybe, that actually gets to the heart of what sin is. That the essence of sin is us deciding what is right and wrong. Who is God and not? Sin is actually setting ourselves up as God to live according to our priorities, our pleasures. Now, you might not walk around saying, "I am God," but the point that the Bible makes is that's exactly how our heart functions, as though we sit on the throne, that we are the boss. Now, that Jesus was sinless, that he was different, is a claim that was understandably made by his supporters. You get that in Hebrews 4:15, 2 Corinthians 5:21, amongst other places. But it was Jesus' life that demonstrated that he was sinless. See, when you pick up the Gospels and when you as an adult just read them and take them at face value, you find a man who uniquely held together seemingly opposing qualities in sinless perfection. So that he had all of the drive and determination of a successful CEO, alongside the tender compassion of your nana. He commanded the respect of a military leader, yet had the sensitivity of a loving mother. He was gentle without being weak, confident without being arrogant, strong without being brutish. He was accommodating without ever compromising on his values. He was overwhelmingly popular, yet never conceited. Who's done that? Who can live like that? In fact, Jesus once asked his opponents, his enemies, if they could show him to be guilty of any sin. The best that they could come up with was blasphemy, that he was claiming to be God, the very claim that actually got him killed. You know, regret is actually, the Bible saying, an acknowledgement of our sin. I don't doubt that we all regret doing things, even this week, yeah? But you think back through your life, we have things that we deeply regret. We wish we had not done them, or we wish we had done them. We wish we had not hurt a person like that. But you know, Jesus had no regrets because he only ever did right to people. Jesus' life as a man shines of perfection possible only by God. Second thing we see when we look at Jesus is his miracles. Now, a miracle being something that is outside of established natural laws. That is, he did things that only a creator of nature, only the upholder of those natural laws could do. Now, magic is in fashion right now, yeah, on TV, in the movies. But magic relies on illusion and distraction. But people, even in the first century, knew the difference between magic and reality. They knew that the wind and the waves are not bossed around by any man. And yet we find Jesus say to a violent storm, "Be quiet, die down," and it does. They knew that a man who had been dead for 4 days, whose body was decomposing in the hot Middle Eastern climate, did not get up and walk out again. And yet we find Jesus saying to a man, Lazarus, who'd been dead 4 days, "Come out." And he did. A fact that was even upheld, not disputed, by his enemies. Which takes us to the most extraordinary demonstration of Jesus being God, which is his own resurrection. Now, as I said last week, we'll give this issue a whole night at Life. The series you've heard about starts this week. We'd love to see you there. But let me just give you a taste of it right now. There's much more to be said, but 4 things. Firstly, that Jesus claimed his resurrection was coming. Repeatedly, he said, "I'm going to die, and then 3 days later, I'm going to rise again." Now, that's a crazy claim, isn't it? Until it's demonstrated to be true. That's just asking for failure and the label of lunatic, unless it's demonstrated to be true. Secondly, you've got to deal with the fact of the empty tomb. The fact that no one has ever been able to produce the body. In fact, where would be the worst place to start a new religion that all hangs on the fact that a dead man came back to life? Where would be the worst place to start that religion if it wasn't true? Well, surely in the city that his body was buried in, Jerusalem. But in fact, that's exactly where Christianity came to life. All it would have taken is, here's the body, we can all go home now. No one has ever produced the body. There is no shrine for the founder of Christianity like there are for other religions. Thirdly, you've got to deal with the fact of the many witnesses, that hundreds of people were still alive who saw the resurrected Jesus at the time of New Testament writing. It's not like that all died and then the claim was put down. No. It was put down whilst you could have gone and asked people, was it true? Fourthly, you've got to answer the implausibility of conspiracy theories. That is, there was no ulterior motive, at least satisfactory one, that the Jews stole his body or the Romans stole his body, which is sometimes claimed. In fact, when you start thinking into it, and we'll do this at Life, you actually find that they had absolutely no reason to do this. They would have loved to show you the dead body. Christianity would have disappeared, or the headaches for the Romans and the heresy for the Jews just would have disappeared. Now, there possibly was a motive, an ulterior motive for the disciples. But I'll come back to why in a moment. I don't believe that holds up. Which is easier to claim? That you are God or that you will rise 3 days after your death? Which is easier to claim? You're God or that you're going to rise? Well, surely claiming to be God is quite easy, really, because how do you really know? Like, you'll be labelled as a lunatic, but it's kind of, might be, but how would you know? But claiming that you will rise from the dead, well, now you've got something tangible to work with, because either you rise or you rot. The evidence overwhelmingly points to Jesus rising from the dead. Hence throwing an amazing amount of light back on his claims as to who he is and what he's about. Amazing line of evidence. So that's looking at Jesus. Last category, heading towards the end, looking at others. Firstly, worship. See, I made the point earlier and repeatedly because it's important that the Jewish scriptures held that there'd be one universal God and that to hold anyone or anything other than Yahweh to be this God was blasphemy, deserving of death. Jesus was a Jewish man. For him to claim that he was Yahweh ought to have meant that he was labelled a blasphemer, which he was, ought to have meant that he'd be killed, that he actually was, unless he was telling the truth. Jesus' disciples, they were ordinary men, Jewish men. Some of them were fishermen, one of them was a tax collector. They deserted Jesus at his death. They took him to be a failure. And yet, they write the New Testament claiming that Jesus is God. Given their beliefs in one almighty God, what on earth changed good Jewish men to worship this Jesus as God? The resurrection. The resurrection was like the key that unlocked all of this other evidence showing Jesus to be God, a taste of which I'm giving you tonight. You get one example in John chapter 20. Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, shows up in a room where all the disciples are huddling in fear of the Jews. This is going to happen to us. They're going to kill us like they killed him. Jesus shows himself to them. There was one disciple not there. His name was Thomas. Jesus left. Thomas came back. The disciples said, "Hey, Thomas, you're never going to believe it. Jesus is alive." Thomas says, "You're right. I don't believe it. Dead people don't come back to life. I'm not going to believe it until I see him, until I can touch him." Jesus shows up, says, "Thomas, touch me." What's Thomas's response? "My Lord and my God." A good Jewish man worshiping Jesus to be his God. The right thing Jesus should have done if he was not God was deflect it, diffuse it, or rebuke Thomas, but rather he accepts it. The belief of monotheistic Jews that Jesus was God in the flesh and worthy of their worship is compelling evidence for Jesus being God. Second point, as we look at others, were they deluded? Were they deluded? Well, one of the reasons that you know they weren't is because of the suffering that followed for them. See, the Jews at large rejected Jesus' claim that he was the Son of God. And they considered any Jew who believed that to be a heretic, deserving of death. And you see this unfold in Acts chapter 7, which records the history after Jesus' death. A man named Stephen, a Jewish man, who is being stoned to death because of his unswerving belief that the resurrected Jesus is God. As he's being stoned to death, he prays to Jesus. Now, you only pray to someone that you believe is powerful, is God, is able to hear you and help you. He prays to Jesus. Would you die for a lie? In fact, history records the consequences for the disciples holding their unswerving belief that Jesus is God. You get James, who was beheaded in AD 44. Philip was crucified AD 54. Matthew was slain with a spear. James, the brother of Jesus, was stoned and then had his brains bashed out with a club. The list goes on. All of them were killed bar one, John. Who would die for a lie? The point of this line of evidence is that many men and women who were contemporaries of Jesus died for their belief that he was God. Powerful and compelling evidence. There is much more I can give you, but I'm going to leave it there. I've got three quick points. So what? So what with all this evidence? What does that mean for us? I've got three quick points. I might give you two of them and then see if we've got any questions. So what that Jesus is God? Well, firstly, it tells you that God is knowable. He's knowable. You don't have to wonder, is he there? What's he like? You've just got to look at Jesus in the Bible. Anyone who has seen me, says Jesus, has seen the Father. The Old Testament, Yahweh, the one true God, reveals himself partially, truly, but partially. The New Testament, he reveals himself fully in the person of Jesus. But why did he do this? Why did God come to earth? Well, second point, it tells you that forgiveness of sin is possible. That actually takes me to the reading that we had read that I don't have time to unpack with you about the paralytic being healed. But that account tells you why God came to earth in Jesus. And it's not so that sick people might be healed, but so that sinful people might be forgiven. Jesus came to make it possible for people who have lived their life as though they were God, ignoring the one true God, to actually come back into relationship with God, which is what he seeks. I don't have time to unpack how he does that, but you get a hint of it in one of the verses we did read. John chapter 10, Jesus is comparing himself or making himself the shepherd. I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The key to our forgiveness is there, that actually in Jesus' death, he brings about the possibility of our forgiveness, that we might come back into relationship with a God who is relationship, who seeks to have you back. I might pause there. How are we going to do this, Chris? I think we've done this before. We've seen if any test questions come in, and I'll see what I can do with them.
Alrighty. Hello. All right. Okay, so we do have a couple. They came flooding in. If it is true, why don't more people believe? If it is true, if there is that much evidence, why so few believers?
Good question. Because as grateful as we are with the number of people who are gathered here tonight, who have been here across the weekend, even the number of people who are in church on the Central Coast this weekend, there are hundreds of thousands of people who haven't given a rip to this kind of thing. So, yeah, don't let this kind of number fool you as to, as I'm sure what you know, many people not believing Jesus to be God or even caring. Why don't more people? Well, Jesus actually says that for the people who have access to the Bible, it can't be because there is a lack of evidence, as I trust I've given you a taste for tonight. It can't be because there's not a lack of evidence. And yet Jesus said, if you are going to come after me, then you need to lay down your life. You need to actually, he says, pick up your cross, which is a way of saying, come and follow me, which is the way of suffering. That's not a great marketing slogan for Christianity. But Jesus said, that's what it's going to be. And so there's a reality that as you look into this Jesus, you're going to hear him say that. And you're going to be caused to think, is it worth it? Well, I put it to you, who he is and what's at stake, it's absolutely worth it. But yet, to follow Jesus is hard. But secondly, and this is probably the big reason, life's pretty good without him. Why do we need Jesus? You said it earlier, we live in a beautiful place. I've got a sweet life. Why should I even care about Jesus? Spent all of last week dealing with that issue. If you weren't here, chase that up online. So I think many people don't believe because they just don't care. They don't want anyone else ruling over their life. And oh, if he's there, I don't want to go there. I just want to keep living my sweet life as boss.
All right. Another one. One of your arguments was that there's tangible evidence. One of your arguments for tangible evidence was that why would someone die for a lie? Why then would someone like a terrorist die for a belief, or what would you claim a lie and kill others with them?
Yeah, good question. Comes up a lot, particularly at life. So if Jesus is telling the truth, he shows Islam to be false, to be a lie. He shows every other world religion, ideology, philosophy to be false. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, says Jesus. So if you can show Jesus to be true, you can show every other claim to be false. But what if Islam was false and people do fly planes into buildings believing it to be true? But what if Christianity was false as well and the disciples were dying for a lie just as Muslims do? The key difference is it was these disciples who would have come up with the lie, not inherited it 1,000 or 1,500 years later in the case of Islam. So for the person who inherits it now and goes, it's true, doesn't excuse them, but they didn't come up with it. They're absolutely convinced that it is true. Mind you, and I want to say this respectfully, because I love the opportunity to engage with people from all different kinds of backgrounds and hear, what do you think? Why do you think this? As you push and prod into some of those, the thinking of Muslims, they actually don't want to go near the evidence for Muhammad. They actually, no. God, Allah, submit. I just want to hold on to what I believe. I don't actually want to push into whether it's true or not. Whereas Christianity begs of you to push it and prod it, because in essence, it's about truth. And so the difference there is the disciples would have fabricated the very lie that they started to see their mates getting slaughtered for. And surely any sane person at that point goes, whoa, sorry, we made it up. I'm not. But they couldn't. They didn't, because they saw Jesus. What takes Peter? What do you know about Peter? As Jesus dies, what was Peter doing?
Running. Hiding.
Yeah. So the eve of Jesus' death, actually around that context we had read, Peter is observing from a distance. He's followed. And he's going, what's going on here? And then a slave girl says, hey, you were with Jesus. You were with that bloke. What does he say?
No, it wasn't. I don't know him.
Yeah. And he's scared of this slave girl. You're onto it, man. Totally. Three times he denies that he was even with Jesus to a slave girl. Then you find Peter up in front of hundreds, then thousands of his own countrymen, Jews, declaring that they, the Jews, had killed the Lord of life. What takes a man from an absolute wimp to, kill me if you want to, this is who he is, the resurrection. They couldn't help but hold it to be true.
Alrighty. How do we know that the early Christian community didn't just add in those passages that argue or prove Jesus was God? Maybe a bit more brief.
Yeah.
If possible.
What was that?
A bit more brief if possible.
Okay. I'm not famous for my brevity. Okay. Well, it's hard to be brief, man, because there's lots to be said. 1 Corinthians 15.
Come to life.
Come to life. 1 Corinthians 15 is affirmed by historians to be of the earliest writings that we have in the New Testament. And it's written by Paul, and he says, verse 3, for what I received, I passed on to you. So Paul isn't coming up to this. He's talking about a tradition that he has already received. Paul comes very close after the life of Jesus, yet he's already received this. I passed on the first of importance that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, who is Peter, and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep, some have died. That is, if you don't believe me, go ask them. Then he appeared to James, the apostle, last of all, he appeared to me. So you have right there an affirmation of a tradition that was in existence prior to even the first New Testament writings. Cool. How's that? Sure enough?
That was good.
How are we going for time?
I don't know.
Let's go. One more. Oh. Maybe two more.
In Matthew 6:63-66, the Jews understand the claims Jesus made but didn't believe he was God. These are people who saw Jesus just like John. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Good. Matthew 6:63 doesn't even exist. What verse? Now you're messing with me.
It says 6:63-66. Can we get some clarity on that?
No, not in Matthew 6, unless I'm missing it.
26?
Verse 26? Chapter 26.
Missed it too.
Chapter 26, oh, what we read. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. you know, you get an account in Luke chapter 4, so let me take you somewhere else, where Jesus performs amazing miracles, yet the people in his hometown reject him, so he won't actually do any miracles there. The point there is that just that you see, they saw Jesus bring Lazarus back to life. They didn't dispute that that happened. They just rejecting him. So clearly, just seeing or just being present. So when people say, well, if Jesus rocked up today in my lounge room whilst I'm watching TV, then I'll believe. No guarantee. People back then didn't. Why? Oh, I can't give a short answer. Hardness of heart, not wanting to accept God come as he had promised. Those kind of, back to that kind of first question. Cool. Last one?
Yeah, last one. A bit of a segue there as well. Why doesn't he just show up today?
yeah, for that reason. Now, Jesus was a man. I hope you're picking that up. Fully God, but fully man. Now, 2,000 years ago, even the same today, though technology has helped a bit, a man can only be in one place at one time. And so, Jesus, for him to actually be known, was never going to be known by the world by getting around himself. And so he actually said, you know what, apostles, I want you to record what I've said, what I've done, what I'm on about, so that by recording it, this could actually be accurately copied. And again, you can push into the evidence for that. And the entire world, or that's what we're trying to do anyway, could have access to Jesus in a way that you couldn't if he was just a man. And so you do have access to Jesus. You have access to more of Jesus than the people did who saw him. They just saw a miracle or heard a sermon. You have every account that has been deemed important for us to hear. And actually, let me finish with what John says at the end of his gospel. Why did he record these kind of things? Why did the apostles write this down? Why do they die for it? He tells you, John chapter 20, verse 31. Jesus performed many other signs, which is his word for miracles, in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name. Friends, to worship Jesus is not to sing about him, though it might be that. It's not merely acknowledging him to be God or referring to him as God, though it will at least involve that. To worship Jesus is to live before him as the one who is worthy of every corner of your life. It is to give him your allegiance. Yes, you are God. Yes, you do have a rightful claim over my life, every corner of it. Yes, I'm going to trust you. Yes, I'm going to follow you. Because yes, I believe you came to bring me life. You came to bring me forgiveness. You came to bring me back to my God. Friends, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that points to Jesus being who he said he is, God. And therefore, there's no one more important that you must deal with. Let me pray on behalf of us and I'll finish. Lord God, we are thankful that you have spoken, that you have revealed yourself, that you have communicated yourself, that you have done this fully, truthfully, in the person of Jesus. For those among us tonight who lack clarity and confidence as to who he is, might you be gracious to bring that, please. For those of us who do worship him as the one true God, might you bring the same to us, a greater clarity, a deeper confidence, a greater joy in following him, a greater desire to live for him, a greater experience of the life to the full that he promised he came to bring. We pray this in his name. Amen.